At this time, the chairperson should briefly qualify requirements of chair and meeting at the Central Orlando Group Saturday night speaker meeting. Our 1 year of continuous sobriety, have Central as your home group and attend a group conscious meeting. And my name's Robin again, and I'm definitely an alcoholic. And I have done those things. And thank you so much for allowing me to chair September's speaker meeting. It's been an honor and a privilege. And, you know, before I came to the promises have definitely come true in my life. Usually when I chair, someone read more about alcoholism, but it's a little long, and since I took up most of the time spilling my coffee, I figured I'd do the promises. But I came in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous for years. I got here real young, and unfortunately I didn't get sober till I was a lot older. But, you know, I never wanted to be here. I always knew I was an alcoholic. In the side of my big book, it says age 16 is when I know it happened to me. And, you know, I didn't get here till I was 38. So I came in and out of the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous looking why I was different than you, never looking at the similarities. But like more about alcoholism talks about, it says that, you know, alcohol is a great convincer. And that's my experience. You know, I got sober, well, I quit drinking in the early 20s, and after 5 years decided that a drink would be a good idea because I did not have a spiritual defense against the first drink. And I had a 6-year jitter, which I'm forever grateful for. So if you didn't get the first time, I didn't either. It took me a really long time to get it. But the good news is I eventually drank enough that I was convinced. And I came in and I became willing. I got a sponsor. I worked the 12 steps. I got in the middle. And if you're new, that's the best recommendation I can give you, is to get in the middle. Because when things are good, the middle's good. But when things fall apart, which they do sometimes because that's life, the middle's the greatest place to be. And so I'm just really glad to be here. And I'm grateful I'm an alcoholic. And I didn't like people that said that. So if you're mad at me, it's okay. You'll get it eventually. All right. We got the guy with the money. Take that. And now I get to introduce the speaker. And Chuck doesn't probably know this, but he saved my butt this 2 years ago. I went through a divorce, as some of you know, because you all listen to me whine and cry. And I remember my husband, ex-husband, is a member of this group also, and so it was very difficult because I had to see him all the time. And I fell apart, and I made a decision I was going to leave Central. And Chuck saved me. Chuck invited me to the small room. I don't know if you've ever been in there. It's not really as scary as we all hear. There's people in there with a lot of long-term sobriety, and so there's some great stuff that goes on there. And he told me that I could go in there, and I told him I was going to cry, and he told me it was okay. They'd give me 30 days, and then after 30 days, they would probably tell me the truth. And, of course, for 30 days I cried, but I heard lots of great things in there because there were men in there that had been sober 30 years. And they'd gone through all kinds of things. And Chuck himself went through a lot, which he'll share tonight. But what I found out is that I didn't have to drink no matter what. And, of course, on the 31st day, I left there and I came back to the big room and I cried for another 2 years. But he made me stay here, and I'm just forever grateful. So if I wouldn't have been in the middle, I'd probably be out there drinking right now. And I'm just so grateful for the middle and for the people that have been in the middle a really long time and encourage us to get in the middle. And with that, I'll give you Chuck.
Well, that was nice. I'm Chuck. I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Chuck.
I got a lot of things on my mind here I wanted to tell you about, but now they're sort of slid away. I want to start on a light note, and somebody told me I had to tell you this poem. This is an old Irish poem. A lot of you have heard it before. And it was written a long time ago by a drunk. Can you imagine an Irish drunk? So I'll do my best to use Irish accent on this. And it goes like this. The thing I most remember from that evening in September, when carrying home me load with manly pride, was me legs began to sputter. So I sat down in the gutter, and a pig came by and sat down at me side. We sang songs of fair weather and of how good friends get together, when a lady passing by was heard to say, You can tell a man who boozes by the company he chooses. The pig got up and slowly walked away. So, with that, I was thinking, coming down here, I've got sort of a canned speech. I've all my AA, my sobriety date is September 83, and all of that has been in Central Florida. And in fact, a couple of years of AA before I got sober were in Central Florida. So I've been doing this for a while. And I remember this lady who saved my life. There are several discrete situations that I'm aware of where people saved my life. And this lady that some of you knew was the reason why I'm alive and sober today. But she got the idea of this drinking thing. I'll tell you a little story about how that happened. She used to bring me to speakers' meetings. And I was still drinking, and I would listen. And one time we were going home in the car, and I said, you know, those people, they get up there and talk about all the things they did wrong. If I ever get the chance to get up there, I'm going to tell them all the things I did right. And she very calmly said, what would that be? And Lord knows she was correct. But the reason I bring that up is that I didn't realize that when somebody was up there talking, they were talking about me. They weren't talking just about them. They were talking, they're alcoholics and I'm an alcoholic. And it was quite some time before I realized these people were trying to tell me something. There was a guy named Wes, some of you knew here. And he would go out of his way. Sometimes he was gentle and waited till after the meeting to tell me I was completely off base. Sometimes he didn't wait. But anyway, guys like that spoke up and just gently usually push me in the right direction. So if you're here and you're new and you think, well, what the hell has that got to me do with me? Because that old fart is up there telling all that stuff he did wrong, which is what I'm going to do. Now, what's that got to do with me? Well, it does have something to do with you, maybe. And I'll let you decide that. Anyway, I got to get drunk for a little while and then we'll get sober. So my story with early exposure to alcohol was absolutely routine for people around here. It's just an immediate love affair as a teenager. And then, of course, that went on for about 30 years. But in that period of time, many, many things happened. A lot of them were pretty good. I came from a good family. My parents didn't drink. My mother said she was allergic to alcohol, at which I scoffed. Would you scoff at that today? There were four boys in the family, and two of them died alcoholic-related deaths. And the fourth one, interestingly, married a lady and told him, she said, it's me or alcohol, and we always thought he chose the wrong one. He chose her. So, but of course, he did choose the right one. And so the years went by, and this academic family that I lived with made it easy for me to do things in school, and so I sort of breezed through those without working as hard as I could have. And I got by, and I accomplished a fair amount of stuff drinking, but always drinking and always more and more and more. And I just loved it, and I couldn't imagine why anybody wouldn't want to drink. And I scoffed at people who didn't enjoy alcohol. And in any case, there wasn't anything particular happened. I didn't get any DUIs. I've never had a DUI. I got a drunken disorderly one time when I was in school. Spent the night in the slammer. I didn't like that much, as you might know. And I learned some tricks when you get stopped when you're drinking. I'm sure all of you have learned those tricks. Sometimes they work. They work sometimes for me. All the time, I guess. never got a DUI. But I was finishing up school, and I met this lady, and it was the right time to get married. All my buddies were getting married, so we got married. And that was the worst thing that she ever did. But it wasn't the greatest for me either. But we had three wonderful kids, and they're all strong supporters today, in spite of an interim period where that wasn't so. In any case, we came down to Florida nearly 50 years ago, and I was not a very good daddy, and I was a really bad husband. And I did some things that were sort of amusing, I suppose, but really were pretty destructive to the marriage. She had enough of me. And by 1978, she said adios, and I went and got my lawyer, who is a very dear friend of mine today, Mike W., and he said to say hello to you all. He's in a nursing home getting over an abdominal surgery, but he's doing well. Some of you know him from the little room. He's a regular down there. But anyway, that divorce situation was over. Oh, I want to tell you this one little story that some people in here like me to tell. When I was drinking, one of the bad things that I did on a regular basis was I went and shacked up with ladies. And this time I went to Atlanta, and I went with this strange lady who was not strange to me, but she was certainly strange to my wife. And we went to this hotel up in Atlanta, and it was a real nice hotel, and we were up maybe in the 10th floor or something. It had this great big central atrium and all the rooms going around. And I got so drunk on that Saturday night that I knew how bad I was, that I put a chair underneath the door handle on the inside to keep me from going out. Because I knew if I went out, that wrought iron fence, or whatever you call it, was not high enough to keep me from going over. So I was really, really bad Saturday night. So I wake up in the morning and I say, oh, God, I felt so bad. Well, I had to have some more booze, so I called the bell captain. I said, bring up a quart of vodka right away to my room, would you? And a Sunday paper, right away. So about an hour later, he shows up, and he's got a bottle of vodka and a Sunday paper. I said, my God, man, what took so long anyway? You know, it's an hour since I called. I guess it's hard to get vodka in Atlanta on Sunday. He says, no, but it's hard to get a Sunday paper on Monday. So, does that suggest any blackout situation? Anyway, that was a highlight of my life in those days, so you can imagine how far I had sunk. The year after my divorce, my AA story begins, and so I can start getting sober a little bit here now. So it'll be a little bit, little yet. I met Patricia, this lady, in 1979, and it was the first lady that I ever had met who drank like I did. And I know there's a lot of ladies in this room that drank like I did, but you're fortunate you didn't meet me. So, we hit it off right away, but very shortly, and with a matter of months, we realized that we were really getting quite destructive in our drinking habits. And we try to calm down, and we tried one time that we quit for a week or two or a month maybe. And then we decided to celebrate, and you know how alcoholics celebrate. So that was the end of that deal. So finally, Patricia decided, she was a little more concerned about herself, or probably me too, than I was. because I knew I was an alcoholic, but I just, it wasn't that bad, you know? I'm sure some of you know exactly what I mean by that. And anyway, she went to a party on a Saturday afternoon in 1981. And she told me this story, and I know it's so. And a guy came up to her and said, you know, I've been watching you, Patricia, at the party here, and you drink like I drink, and I'm an alcoholic. And I know some ladies that are alcoholics that don't drink anymore, and they really have a good time. Would you like me to call them? And amazingly, Patricia said, yes. And so, yeah, I agree. I wouldn't have, would you? So anyway, he did. And the remarkable, even more remarkable thing was, as she left, she told me the guy came up to her and said, Patricia, I hope this worked for you, because it didn't work for me. Now here's a guy who's an AA dropout who's carrying the message. That's pretty remarkable. That sounds a little bit like a higher power's in there somewhere, doesn't it? Anyway, I took her to her first meeting that night, and she really needed to be there. Of course, I wasn't ready to go in, but she liked it right away, just as I liked the people particularly. And so she told me she really liked it, and she went back, and I found out within a short time that you guys told her you had this very radical idea that she not drink at all. Can you imagine? I mean, that's not a way to control your drinking. But indeed, that's what you told her. And of course, they also told her that she better unload me. And so she did that periodically, and I'd come crawling back, and I'd promise and so forth. But I didn't perform. I kept drinking. And she finally slipped after a year or so, and then about a year later, we both finally stopped about the same time. But I had to get her out of AA some way. I couldn't think, how am I going to do this, you know? Because I've lost my drinking buddy. You know, you can't get along without your drinking buddy. Particularly Patricia, right, Julie? And so I finally thought of the scheme that would do it. I took her aside and I said, now, Patricia, we need to have a serious talk here. You are doing group therapy. And they're delving into your consciousness, your soul, and they're not licensed. That's what she did. She laughed. That didn't work, but I thought it was a great idea. Anyway, so she basically told me it was AA or amen for me. And we started going to these meetings, as I told you. And I kept drinking, and I was I'd gotten to the point now where I knew I couldn't stop easily. But I wasn't about to go to one of those rehab places or one of those drying out places, so I just decided I'm just going to have to shake through this. So I had shook through the last time, but I knew this was going to be worse. By this time, I was so addicted to alcohol, I have a weak stomach. I think I might have saved my life, because when I was a kid, we'd go out drinking beer with the boys and drink industrial quantities of beer, and they would seem to do fine, but I'd get full and I'd go to the bushes and empty my stomach and go back and drink some more. And they didn't do that, I don't think. And so I thought, in retrospect, maybe that reduced the amount of alcohol that I consumed. But when I came down to Florida, I finally had had enough education. I had a good job, and I had a little money, so I could start drinking whiskey, which I did, and drank it like beer, and you know how that works. But I still had a weak stomach, as in it worked out. I got gastritis so bad from drinking whiskey that I ended up on wine. So I'm drinking wine here at the end. And I'm drinking 3 liters of wine every day, one of those big jugs. Plus, what else I'm drinking when I go play liar's poker with my buddies in the afternoon. And I'm trying so hard to quit. Pouring a drink out of one of those big 3-liter jugs is pretty inconvenient, you know. So I'd pour it into a 1-liter thing. And I'm pouring myself 1-ounce drinks of wine. Now, there's about 100 ounces in a big jug. And if you're awake for 16 hours a day and you drink 1-ounce drinks, 100 of them, that means you're drinking 6 of them every hour. So I'm drinking 1 ounce of wine every 10 minutes. That's a little insane, wouldn't you say? But I just couldn't stop. So anyway, I've got a hold of some barbiturates. I knew that might keep me from convulsing in my withdrawal. And sure enough, I shook through that weekend, and that was in September of 83. And that's when the miracle began for me. I went to a meeting every day. And by the way, earlier, while I'd still been drinking, I was going to this meeting once a week, and this little Irishman, Joe, some of you knew, would come up to me every Monday, and he'd say, "Hiya, Chuck, you had enough?" Boy, that got old. "Hiya, Chuck, you had enough?" Of course I hadn't had enough. He knew that, and I knew that. But anyway, Joe kept doing that for 2 years. Anyway, so finally now I go to that meeting on a Monday night, and there's Joe, and I said, "Joe, I had enough." He says, "Good, I think I'm done with Joe." Wrong. Just getting started with Joe. So, a few weeks go by. I'm not drinking. I'm feeling better. I've stopped shaking. Starting to sleep at night. Starting to eat a little properly. So on and so forth. All stuff you guys know. And I really like the people in AA. Always had. And the fellowship of the parking lot is basically the way I got my life saved, I think, by you guys, particularly early on. I didn't bring anything here with me. Except fear. That's what I kept sober on for a long time, fear. Well, here comes Joe. "Hiya, Chuck, are you in?" Oh, God, I thought I was done. What the hell does that mean? Are you in? Yeah, Joe, honey. I'm not going to ask him what he means, of course. I never would admit any ignorance about anything. So, anyway, the time goes by, and I'm doing a lot better. I'm feeling better, and Patricia and I are getting better, and we're going to get married, and indeed we did. Just about the same time I started coming apart at the seams, and I was the most graphic example of what was happening in my mind was I would see somebody coming into the meeting. And I would know I didn't like what that person said. So I would get up and go into the other room. And I wasn't even like that when I got here. So I knew, I'm not doing this just right. Something's wrong here. And by the way, I'd asked Joe in the meantime to be my sponsor. They said to pick somebody you don't like a whole lot. Joe, I really did like him a lot. But anyway, the meetings that I was going to had suffered from one major problem, as I look back. They were filled with people like me. And so there wasn't a whole lot of sober experience in there. And that's what we talk about in these rooms. My later sponsor, Bill O, he explained it nicely, I think, He said, you know, in AA, we say right in our preamble, we share our experience, strength, and hope. And he looked at me and he says, you know, the experience we're talking about here is the sober experience. And you don't have any. Does that give you an idea of what you should be saying in the meetings? So that's what I did. I just said, I'm Chuck, I'm an alcoholic, and I pass. That served me well. I knew other people told me later that they spent most of the meeting composing what the hell it was they were going to say later on. And so I didn't have to suffer from that. But and our pal Mike, he was exactly the same way. It's interesting, we were talking about that recently. So, but I'm going nuts in these meetings, and I can't talk to Joe. Here's another principle that I learned through that experience with Joe. I never should have asked Joe to be my sponsor. He was in the same business I was in. And anybody that I knew well, I would lie to. I'm not going to tell him what a scumbag I am. Particularly if he's in the same business, you know, it could hurt me, right? And Bill said, Oakley, he said, it takes strangers to get you sober. Get a stranger for your sponsor. Anyway, so I had this stranger guy that I respected a lot up in Jacksonville. And I called him up and I told him what I just told you. I was going nuts. And of course, he didn't really know me real well. He said, well, maybe it's the meetings you're going to. You want to go to meetings that have two characteristics. One is that they speak from experience. They talk about their experience. They don't have any wild theories or stuff they've read somewhere. It's experience. That's base. I got that. He said, and the other thing is they talk about the solution to alcoholism. They don't talk about the problem with alcoholism. And I didn't quite get that. But I found myself in my usual chair half an hour later, as it by chance. And a person walks in and says, I'm Harry, I'm your chairperson tonight. Has anybody got a problem? And I realized, geez, maybe that's what he's talking about. We talked about jail, alimony, child support, angry people in the family and not in the family. We talked about all kinds of problems, but we didn't spend a whole lot of time talking about the solutions. At least if we did, I missed it. And I realized, gee, maybe I ought to be going somewhere else, because I've been going to this same group every single day. And so at that same time, a couple other guys that I knew, a guy named Greg, a guy named Bob K, Big Bob, and the guy we called the Poet, moved to Atlanta. A couple of these guys have moved away, but we all seemed to want to start new meetings. And we did. We started a meeting that we named There Is a Solution, after that chapter in the big book, on a Friday night. And indeed, it was a big book meeting. And, gee, I had never been exposed to the big book. I thought it was sort of like a history book. You know, it's something that you could look at if you wanted to find out about the history. But and that isn't what it is at all, of course. It's a book of instructions. It's a book, a manual for alcoholics to get better. And so we studied that, and one thing led to another along there, and I realized I thought I was hooked up with this higher power. The first step I had taken half of many years earlier, namely I knew I was an alcoholic. The part about unmanageability, yeah, I had that. I understood that. It was okay. I guess it wasn't a real good idea to be throwing empty 3-liter jugs of wine out on the I-4 every day, that sort of thing. But anyway, and then the second step, which sort of suggests that we have to think about this idea of God or the loving power that will save our sorry souls, I didn't really look at it quite that way. At the time, I looked at it more like, I think I'm just going to stick around here. These guys have obviously got something that I don't have because they don't drink. I figured that out a long time earlier, that I was missing something. So I stuck around the second step. But I took the third step, and I thought that was a monumental move. I thought in the third step, I had hooked myself up with the higher power, and that was fine. And I didn't seem to need all the rest of that stuff, because I was now hooked up. I conveniently overlooked what it says in our big book, namely, that we don't get much out of the third step, unless it's followed immediately or shortly by beginning an inventory and starting the fourth and then the fifth step. So I did that, finally started stepping forward. By this time, I'm hanging around with Patricia enough. She's praying a lot. I'm praying, but I'm not very comfortable praying. But I go through the motions because Patricia is really special. So I go up finally to this guy again, David T. up in Jacksonville, a good friend of Aubrey's, who a lot of you remember Aubrey. And I did that fifth step with him. On the way home from Jacksonville, or shortly thereafter, I think it might have been actually that same day, I had an awareness that there's that line in How It Works where it says, we stood at the turning point. And I realized, I've been standing at the turning point for 2 or 3 years here, and finally, I think I joined AA today. I'm in. Hey, I'm in. Joe, where the hell are you? And indeed, that proved to be the case. I was talking before the meeting about how you don't realize, at least I don't realize, the outcome of certain things that I've done in this program until after I've done them. And I just, it was astounding to me that the difference that made it take that step and fess up to what a loser I was. And of course, he had his own stories. So that was a good experience. And then followed by the sixth and seventh right away. And I realized how I amazingly had been very honest and totally bared my sorry ass for this guy. And then going on with the aid of a sponsor, which is now Bill O, to do the eighth and ninth steps. And that wasn't real easy. If you've done them, I imagine it wasn't real easy for you either. But I had three guys in particular that were really tough, and one of them was very, very difficult. But the other two were just fine, and I got through that with no regrets. I'm glad I did that today. And then the tenth step, which is sort of a recapitulation of doing the fourth through the ninth, on special incidents that happen on a daily basis. And those incidents get less and less as you get older and you get more mature in AA, and particularly when you stop working. That is a great way to get rid of anxiety. Anyway, so now doing these steps, and I'm praying regularly, and everything is so comfortable, and Patricia's supportive and I'm supportive, and we got a good thing going. And then this 11th step is the thing that I prize the most, and in fact that was the word that I learned to associate with the 11th step, that it is the prize, it is the medal, it is the award that a drunk like me gets for taking the first 10th steps. It says in our book, lack of power was our dilemma. The Arkansas Traveler used to like to define things. You remember Leroy? He says a dilemma is a situation you find yourself in that's got more than one way out, and none of those ways are acceptable. And that's where I was when I got here. I could go to AA. Now, Could not go to AA? No. I could stop drinking? No. I could keep drinking? No. No way out. Dilemma. Lack of power. I couldn't do that. Well, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Everything leads up to, in the 11th step, we say, we ask for direction and power to carry out His wish for us, and it works. So that is the prize, that is the award that I got, the way I see it, from cleaning house, starting to be helpful to others, which we're going to do in the 12th, of course, but still. And these things have a reward. And the way I think of it today is I have to sort of ask God for direction and power, and also instill in me somehow the belief that what He's got in mind for me is better than what I got in mind for me. That is a difficult concept for a very selfish person like me. So, anyway, that 11th step is where you've heard people talk, and my sponsor was big on this word, bring your dreams to Alcoholics Anonymous. This is where I think people bring their dreams to Alcoholics Anonymous in the 11th step. I'm talking to God. I say, can you arrange this so that I have such and such, if it be your will, and that sort of a thing. And have some reasonable belief in the outcome that it would be helpful and positive. And from hearing you guys all these years and all the good results that you've had, why not? Why not do that and get comfort from it and do it with enjoyment, not as a chore? So anyway, those are the things that I got from the steps. And then, of course, in having done all those steps, I finally got something that might be of some value to a new guy. Before that, I can take him to meetings and stuff, but I don't really have much to help somebody with if I haven't done these steps. At least that's the way I look at it. But now I do have something very valuable. And this is a very, very big deal. We just had a nice meeting in the little room to which you were all invited the other day, and Joe chaired the meeting, and he was talking about my not drinking today. He was talking about that my, but I'm talking about this my, and I agree with him totally. My not drinking today is a very, very big deal. And it's always going to be a very, very big deal. I think of my three kids, for example. They were embarrassed, ashamed of their father when they were teenagers. About 5 years sober, my son told me, we were out in a boat one day, and he said, you know, Dad, you're my best friend. This is a guy who didn't even want to see my ass. I was the best man in his wedding. My daughters call me up all the time and then ask me questions and tell me stuff, and I love them so dearly, and we're close, and you guys gave me that. And in fact, when they pass out these awards on that last Saturday of every month, the award really ought to go to the group, not to the person. I didn't do this. I don't think you did it either for your sobriety. It's this group and this loving God that can make somebody like me a useful citizen. So, anyway, there's a lot of funny stuff. I can tell you one other funny story, another drunken story. Mike always likes me to tell this. Mike's not here tonight, so I didn't think of that. But it was a Christmas party, and I had been divorced a short time, and I went to this Christmas party in the afternoon, and I got really drunk. And I was living in this gated community, and the party was about 3 blocks away from my house. And it was fairly early, maybe 9 o'clock. I decided I've had enough. I'm going home. So I get in my car to drive the 3 blocks home, and I get lost. And I lived there for several years. So I'm driving down the street, and I say, what did I do wrong here? And I see this house. I say, oh, I know that house. Oh, I'm going the wrong way, because if I were going the right home, right way to get home, that house would be on that side. So I got to turn around. This house has got a circular driveway. I know that. So I'll just pull in circular driveway, and I turn around and go back. So I pulled in. No circular driveway. So I decide, maybe it's in the backyard. So I drive my car alongside the house in the backyard. And there's no circular driveway there. At least there wasn't until I left. So I'm going around in the drive, and there's got all these pine trees and azalea bushes, and it's a pretty big backyard. And I'm trying to turn around and get out of there, and I pull up onto this, between a couple of pine trees, this great big azalea bush. And it's really pretty, and I say, I'm not driving through there. And I don't want to back up. I'm done. I'm staying here. The people are having a Christmas party. The flight lights are flicking on in the backyard. What the hell is that car doing in our backyard? I'm sitting there musing. I thought, you know, we're going to call a gate, and those Seminole sheriffs are going to come over here. This is not a good situation. So I did what any reasonable drunk would do. I slid over into the passenger seat. And I sat there, and the cops came and shone their little lights in there, you know. And they probably said something like, what are you doing here? And I said, just hanging out, you know. Well, how'd you get here? Well, I came up alongside the house there. No. How did you arrive here? Who was driving the car? I said, oh, this guy was driving the car. Well, who was the guy? I don't know. Well, what do you mean you don't know? I said, well, I was at this party and I had too much to drink. And this guy volunteered to drive me home. And that's all I know. But in those days, the cops were much more friendly. I don't think you get away with that crap today. But anyway, I did that day, and one of the cops drove my car home, and the other one drove me home. And the next day, I went and made amends to my neighbor's backyard. But the funny thing about that was, 25 years later, or 30, I run into the next door neighbor. There was a nice lady who lived next door to me out there. It was out in the Springs in Seminole County, if you know that area. And she was a real nice lady. We just bumped into one another. We talked for a little while. She says, tell me, who is really driving the car? You think I told her? Okay, I've got through my drunkologue except for one very important thing, and that was the way things ended up with my wife. She started getting sick in the middle of the 90s, and the doctors told her she was just going through the menopause, but she went way past any menopausal situation. And I took her up to the University of Florida, and they diagnosed a rare degenerative brain disease, which they said was going to take her out in about 7 years, and there wasn't any treatment for it, and they were right. I couldn't leave her home alone after a while. It was dangerous. So I put her in an assisted living place. And I was still working, and I couldn't just, anyway, had to do that. And I was feeling sorry for myself. Poor me. Here, I don't have my wife anymore. And it was a very short time. You guys probably kicked my ass into the right position, or maybe I figured it out, or some combination thereof. But anyway, I figured out that this deal was not about Chuck. This deal was about Patricia. And then I changed, of course, my attitude completely, and I realized this was an opportunity, basically, for me to show my ass. You know, what are you made out of, boy? What can you do in this situation? And, of course, that lifted the load a great deal. Then somebody said something else that I've always remembered. Somebody said something to me like, you want to conduct yourself through this situation in such a way so that 10 years from now, you can look back on it and say, I did a pretty decent job with this. And that helped me too. But so she didn't know who I was or anything. But in the process, she loved this big black poodle that we have, standard poodle. And I'd bring the dog in with me every day, and we'd visit Patricia, and she got so she didn't know the dog or me. But I continued to come with the dog because all these other people were enjoying the company too. And I remember one thing that one time she'd gotten so small. She wasn't a small woman, but when she somehow this illness made her shrink. And she was sitting in this big wing chair, you know, this high back thing, and she's sitting in this little body. And I looked down at her, and I just got real mushy. And I looked down, and I said, you know, Patricia, you're so lucky, aren't you? You have a husband that loves you and cares about you so much. She looks up at me, and she says, yes, would you mind getting him for me? So that was a laugh or cry deal, and like you, I laughed. And but that kind of experience, you can imagine how well a drunk would do in that kind of situation. I would have been a sorry, negative. The people in the nursing place would have said, oh God, here he comes again. And I know what would have happened. But you guys pushed me in the right direction, and that sort of thing is a test. And I know that each of us has tests in here. Robin described one she had recently. And I like to think of the record. We have a record here. It talks in the big book about, let's look at the record. And they're talking in the context of looking at the past. Look at what losers we've been. We can also look at the sober record. And that was one of the things that I think I pointed out to somebody recently. That we, each of us that come here regularly, have got a pretty good record. Not perfect, surely, but we mostly are here to help other people and to learn what we can learn about being useful, sober people. And that's a really big deal, as Joe would say. That is not just a so what, let's learn something more fancy. That's as fancy as I need to get. Okay, let me finish up with Dr. Silkworth says in his doctor's opinion, he closes with something I can't quote exactly, but he basically says, if you're an alcoholic, like the one described in this book, it would serve you well to read this book. And if you came to scoff, you may remain to pray. And that basically is what happened to me when I read that. Yeah, I used to scoff, and today I pray. Now, I just want to ask you all, I want you to speak up and give me your answer. I'm going to ask you all a question. Ready? Are you in? Okay.